Hey everybody, Marshall here. This is a long episode, so I don't want to take too much time up front here, but I just wanted to once again acknowledge the efforts of Rish Outfield for this Delusions of Grandeur podcast. You know, it's here on the Journey Into feed, and Rish and I do this together, but he is the one who edits all of these episodes. Not only this one, but every one. I think I've only done two episodes, and we're at 76 episodes. So thank you, Rish, for all of your efforts for this podcast. This one was especially arduous because we had technical difficulties. I had lost my side of the conversation. I had to recreate that. And that makes the already arduous task of editing the episodes together so much more difficult. And I didn't want this episode to go out without publicly announcing my appreciation for Rish Outfield and everything he does for this Delusions of Grandeur podcast and everything that we're able to do together. I appreciate it and always look forward to talking more Star Wars with Rish. All right, let's get on with the show.
Delusions of Grandeur.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Star Wars Delusions of Grandeur here on the Journey Into podcast.
I'm out of it for a little while. Everybody gets delusions of grandeur.
We are here this week to talk about the final episode, the finale of Season 2 of The Mandalorian. Last time we talked to you, we only talked about the episode The Believer, but we talked so much about that, and we wanted to talk about Jeremy Bullock and get some voicemails in there from Bria, so we weren't able to finish out our coverage, I guess you could call it, of The Mandalorian. So here we are to talk about the finale. But before we get going, I just wanted to tell you that this episode of The Delusions of Grandeur is sponsored by Manscaped.
Huh. What is that?
Oh, I'm surprised you don't know. It seems like every podcast I've listened to is sponsored by Manscaped lately.
A product? Like a razor? Or
It's essentially a product for men to shave their privates.
Well, yeah, it's a great product. My kids swear by it, especially the 9-year-old.
Yeah, it's like a razor. I think there's many other products as well, but what they talk about most is the lawnmower, which is used for taming your privates, I guess. I don't know. Kind of strange. So I thought it would just be funny if I claimed that our podcast was also sponsored by Manscaped.
Was there anything else that you wanted to say? You could tell people who I am and who you are. Although I think the intro does, doesn't it?
It does. I think it depends on which version of the intro you're using. But yes, I am Marshall Latham. And my illustrious co-host here is Rish Outfield. And yes, we are here to talk about... excuse me, I think I need to take a drink of water here.
Okay, well, while you're getting a drink of water, this recap could be super, super fast. I could give you this recap in 5 minutes. Or it could be insanely detailed and slow and take us 40 minutes. And I don't know which is the right way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we don't need to spend too much time. But yeah, we should probably go through it, I guess. We kind of start out, you know, last time we were recruiting people at the beginning of the episode. And we kind of do that again here, where the Mandalorian, Din Djarin, and Boba Fett go to this planet to try to recruit Bo-Katan and her friends. Well, actually, there's only one of her friends there. I don't know where the other guy is.
I think he was the wrong gender, frankly. What would I'll give you $1 if you can tell me the name of the other blue armored Mandalorian that is in this scene.
Oh, wow. I have no idea.
But how do we describe all the things that these ladies do throughout the episode if we can't name them?
Good point.
Okay, well, let me tell you that it's Koska Reeves.
Okay.
But having said that, I will have forgotten that name 5 minutes from now.
Yeah, I doubt I'll remember it either. But yeah, it's kind of a neat scene. I mean, there's things to like and things not to like. But basically, the thing that I liked about it was Bo-Katan kind of sizes up Boba Fett. And, you know, Mandalorian asks for her help, and she says, not all Mandalorians are bounty hunters. And at one point,
you know, she says, you know, you are a clone. I've heard your voice thousands of times.
Sorry, I got to interrupt, man. I don't know anything about Bo-Katan. Did she fight against the clones? Or is she talking about Order 66 when the clones went bad?
No, she fought alongside the clone troopers during the Clone Wars when she was on there. So I don't...
why does she have such disdain for the clones or for Boba Fett or for every single character in this entire episode? Is it because she's played by Katie Sackhoff? Now, cards on the table. I had a real problem with Starbuck on Battlestar Galactica, too, because I never understood why she was so nasty all the time. But it's got to be the actress. What is the deal?
I don't know. She seems to have a big chip on her shoulder.
Now, granted, Boba Fett calls her princess early on, so he recognizes that she is next in line for the throne of Mandalore. I mean, and the only other explanation is that Din Djarin told him this. But I think he just knows who she is.
Yeah, he probably does. You know, I don't know. I think she just has a problem with him, a bounty hunter, somebody who's not a Mandalorian, in her opinion, having the Mandalorian armor. Because he's not a true Mandalorian.
But he never said he was. He even tells her that.
Yeah, you're right.
And he says that the Empire turned Mandalore to glass.
Yeah.
Which I think is sort of a reference of, like, when sand gets really hot, it turns into glass. My guess is that Mandalore was firebombed, and that's what he's saying. She disagrees, though. But again, anything anybody says in this episode, she disagrees with.
Right.
Luckily, it leads to my favorite moment in the whole episode, which is unresolved as of this moment. But yeah, the other one. Oh, what's her name, by the way?
Was it Coos Bay? I don't know.
It's Koska Reeves, but that's okay, because I'll give you three more times throughout this episode to get it. She and Boba Fett are fighting, and they turn on their flamethrowers against each other. And Bo-Katan says, enough. If you had fought that hard against the Empire, Mandalore would never have been lost, which is kind of a nice comment. Mando is there to recruit these two to help, and she, of course, gives him the brush off, but he says they took the child. And she says, who? And he says, Moff Gideon. And she says, you'll never find him. And he says, we know where they are. And then suddenly she's on board. And I guess it took a second viewing for me to realize why suddenly she's on board. Because, she has no interest in him. She's, again, you say she has a chip on her shoulder. She has an iceberg on her shoulder and is totally unwilling to help Mando until he mentions Moff Gideon. And it's because Moff Gideon has this sword, this ceremonial darksaber. How big a deal was the darksaber on the Clone Wars series?
The darksaber was a pretty big deal. I guess we didn't learn in Clone Wars, but we learned in Rebels that Tara Vizsla was the person. He was a Jedi, the first Mandalorian Jedi. And he created the darksaber. But like I said, we don't learn about that until Rebels. When we first see it in the Clone Wars, it's being held by the pre-Vizsla, who must be a descendant of Tara Vizsla. And he's the leader of Death Watch, which is just kind of a break off from Mandalorian. And then at some point, you know, he fights Maul, and Maul beats him and gains the darksaber. He has it for a long time, and he leads the people. And he kind of runs Death Watch, but then has his own kind of crime. He's kind of a crime lord there for a while. Anyway, in Rebels, when Sabine Wren comes in contact. Well, they all come in contact with Maul, and she ends up picking up the darksaber and takes it on and trains with it and takes it on and trains with it. And then later on, it gets passed to Bo-Katan.
Was Bo-Katan in Rebels as well?
She was in a few episodes there toward the end. And that's when she got the Darksaber.
Well, I'm just curious here about the Darksaber and how it works. Gideon pretty much explains everything that we need to know. He acts as just this repository of backstory and information, and it shouldn't work. But Esposito is such a good actor that everything that he says, you believe.
Yeah.
I don't really understand how that works, but he's really solid in this episode. But when Darth Maul got the Darksaber from defeating this leader of Mandalore, was Bo-Katan forced to follow him to do his bidding?
No, she wasn't part of Death Watch. She was on Mandalore with her sister, the Duchess Satine. And so, yeah, that was different at that time.
Okay, and is,
I don't know.
Or was Sabine Wren part of the Death Watch?
No, she came later. She was part of the clan Wren. She came later with Rebels.
Oh, because the Death Watch was 15 years before Rebels, right? Or more.
Right.
It was a decade at least.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's kind of what's going on there with the Darksaber. But I forgot, we actually didn't start out on the planet with Bo-Katan. The episode actually started in space where Slave One and everybody attacks a Imperial shuttle. And they're after Dr. Pershing, who knows what was going on with the Empire and everything. And so, you know, they easily take out the shuttle, they board. But a couple of the pilots on the shuttle try to take Pershing hostage. And there's this moment or this contention between one of the pilots and Cara Dune. He recognizes her tear tattoo, meaning she's from Alderaan. He kind of starts to mock her. And then he talks about all the people that died on the Death Star. He must have watched Clerks or something. And so they kind of have a back and forth. And then he's very angry and she ends up shooting him because he's of his attitude.
Yeah, the guy is so confrontational and so loud that he might as well have shouted diplomatic immunity at that moment. Gandhi would have shot him in the face. I didn't really understand because immediately before that, he said he didn't have a death wish, but of course he did. I didn't understand. There was no logic in that scene at all. Pershing is like the only person who is calm in that whole scene.
Yeah.
And what's strange is he turns over a new leaf immediately. He is all too willing to help our heroes get into this cruiser, get the child back, defeat Moff Gideon. And I don't really understand that. He might be one of those guys who just whoever is in charge, he is willing to serve. But they don't have to twist his arm or threaten him or anything. He just jumps up and is like, this is how you can do this, and this is how you can defeat them. You're going to have a few minutes while the dark troopers boot up and all this stuff. I just didn't really understand the guy, unless he's just in it for the science. And all he wants to do is to be able to study and do his experiments or whatever. And he doesn't care who he's doing it for.
Yeah, that's what I would suspect. You know, that he knows that he's not going to be able to fight his way out of anything. So he just goes along with who's ever in power at the time. But yeah, he does help them plot the attack on the light cruiser. So yeah, they come up with this plan. And essentially, their plan is kind of a sneak attack. And they come out of warp right where the cruiser is going to be. And Slave One is in hot pursuit of the shuttle and it's shooting them, you know. And they radio, they said, hey, we need to land right away. Emergency, emergency. So they end up crash landing into the shuttle pod and disrupt some of the TIE fighters that are coming out to attack Slave One. And essentially, once they get in, Slave One just not warps, but goes into hyperspace. And Boba Fett's essentially gone for the rest of the show. So the attack team, I guess we have Cara Dune, Fennec, Bo-Katan, and Ursa, or whoever it is that's with her. And then their main thing is to get to the bridge and overtake the bridge and get Gideon on the bridge. And so they take off and they shoot through a bunch of stormtroopers, and they have, you know, some really cool fight scenes in there, or, you know, shots where they're taking out the troopers and things like that. And eventually they do take out the bridge. And then the Mando, his mission, he kind of sticks behind and he's going to go after the child. But along the way, he also has to disable the dark troopers, because Pershing has told them all about the dark troopers. The, you know, they're powering up the whole time because Gideon says, you know, power up the dark troopers. And so they're getting ready. It takes them a while to power up. And so Mando's first mission, like I said, is to go and stop the dark troopers from activating, to pull the plug kind of thing. He's late in getting there, and the only thing he's able to do is close the door to prevent the dark troopers from coming out to attack, except one gets through, and he has to fight this dark trooper on his own. And it's a pretty cool fight. I mean, he pretty much tries all of his tricks, and he's not able to do anything against this dark trooper and until he pulls out his Beskar spear. So, of course, he's the one that runs into trouble, where the rest of them were able to get to the bridge pretty quick.
It flies in the face of everything we had seen up to that. And yeah, I don't want to be critical of this episode too much, because I know everybody loves it. But there is no opposition to this group of ladies. They kill 80 or 90 stormtroopers without blinking, without sweating, without the biggest hurdle that they have to overcome is Cara Dune's gargantuan blaster jams at some point. So she beats stormtroopers to death with it. Yeah, then we get this fight between Mandalorian and a single dark trooper, and Mandalorian is overmatched. And that made all the difference. You really care about this fight because there seem to be consequences. This thing is just this giant droid that is so armored that laser blasts just bounce right off it.
Right.
And at one point it like grabs him and it's pile driving his face, his helmet, with its fist, trying to, you know, crush his head. Luckily the Beskar holds, but everything that he does doesn't damage this thing until he grabs his Beskar spear and is able to jab that up into its undercarriage, into its jaw, and kill the dark trooper that way. And when he gets a chance, he ejects all of the other dark troopers out into space, out through the airlock there.
Yeah, which is fortunate, because he wouldn't have been able to take on any more than just the one. And so, yes, he gets them out of the airlock, and then he's accomplished his first mission. Now his only priority is the child. And so he goes straight to the detention center, goes and opens the door, and wouldn't you know it, who's there but Moff Gideon. Of course he would be there. Of course, you know, Mandalorian already told him he was coming for the child. And so when he saw what was going down, Moff Gideon obviously went to the detention area, and they have this confrontation there, and back and forth, you know, Mandalorian has to put down his pistol, and of course, Gideon has the darksaber, but...
And see, this was a really interesting moment, because Moff Gideon says, oh, we'll take him. I've gotten all that I needed from him. I just wanted his blood. He says, but, you know, as soon as you have him, leave this place and leave me be. I think that's the agreement that they make.
Yeah, like they each, you know, want... They're each going to get what they want, and who cares about what's going on? I thought that was interesting, because the Mandalorian agrees to it. You know, he's going to get the child, and he's going to leave. And I wonder, you know, what the others, like Cara Dune and Bo-Katan, will think of that. And when their Mandalorian leaves, I don't know how he's going to leave without Boba Fett, but it turns out that Moff Gideon was lying and just wanted to get the Mandalorian to get his guard down. Because as soon as he starts to walk to grab Grogu, Moff Gideon attacks him with the darksaber. But I don't think he realized that the Beskar armor would be a defense against it. And so Mandalorian and Moff Gideon fight. Again, he brings out the spear, the Beskar spear, which is pretty cool. And their battle is really, really even-handed, I thought. You know, Moff Gideon is very smart. But here we see him be very strong. I think we saw that in episode or in season one as well, where he, you know, he's pretty formidable as an opponent as well. But yeah, there's a lot of back and forth where it looks like Moff Gideon has the upper hand, and then Mandalorian's able to do something. He gets the upper hand, and Moff Gideon says, I know you don't have most of your, you've used most of your resources against the Dark Trooper. And, you know, now you have to deal with me. But eventually, the Mandalorian does win, and he gets him down. And Moff Gideon loses the Darksaber, it goes flying, and then he's on the ground. And so he goes down, and, you know, Mandalorian puts the spear to his throat, but he doesn't kill him. But when Moff Gideon realizes that the Mandalorian isn't going to kill him, you know, he's, of course, surprised, but he's also kind of amused by it. And he says, you know, you're sparing my life. Well, this should be interesting.
The reason he doesn't kill him is because Cara Dune, right? Wait, explain how that works. The rebellion or the New Republic has a reward for his capture, or rather they have a reward for his death, but it's doubled if he is brought in alive.
Yeah.
So maybe that's enough for him to buy a new ship.
Maybe. So eventually, you know, Mandalorian shows up on the bridge and everybody's there waiting, but he's wielding the Darksaber, and Bo-Katan sees this and she's like, what happened? What's going on? You know, because the plan was that she would take on Gideon. But of course, that wasn't possible because Moff Gideon wasn't there. And then Moff Gideon, you know, starts to explain Juan Carlo Esposition, starts to explain why the Darksaber is so important to her, because it shows who's going to rule Mandalore, who's the rightful ruler of Mandalore. And so he's explaining all this and saying it has to be won in combat, and that was what she was after. And we knew that already, but he gives a lot more explanation to that.
He says if she doesn't take it by defeating you in battle, she's a pretender to the throne.
Right.
And Mando doesn't care. He's like, I yield. No, it's yours. And she won't take it. And I think that that's really, really interesting, because I'm of the mind of who cares? I don't hold any ritual like that. I mean, it doesn't mean anything to me. In the same way as it was such a big deal in the first season that nobody see Din Djarin without his helmet on. I was just like, but you've got to eat. You got to shower, dude. You got to sneeze from time to time. But it's the principle of the thing. And I guess it's tied Bo-Katan's hands. Plus, she's got that friend there on the bridge. What is the friend's name?
Oh, jeez. Kuska Raves? Raves? Something like that.
I'll accept it. It's Kuska Reeves.
Oh, see, I was close.
But she's got that witness there on the bridge, and she won't take it. She won't take the sword. So see, that's interesting, because it... This passing of the sword thing, it's some kind of like a rite, a holy rite kind of thing, where I think they have to actually fight. It can't just be a sham.
Yeah.
And he can't just be half-hearted about it. It's one of those things where she's like, you have to fight as hard as you can, and I have to defeat you. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything. Otherwise, people will always say that, you know, I'm not the rightful heir to Mandalore. And that's how I see it. But I don't know, because I don't understand. Was any of that ever established on the animated shows?
Well, sort of. But I was kind of having a hard time with this, because it's a little bit contradictory to what I've seen. You know, there was definitely that fight, like I said, between Maul and Pre Vizsla. And that's how Maul got the saber. But I don't think Sabine had to fight Maul to get the saber. I think it was just laying around where he was, and she picked it up during the course of what they were doing. And then later on, when she gives it to Bo-Katan and says, no, you're the one that needs to lead all the clans of Mandalore against the Empire. Here, take this. And Bo-Katan was a little bit hesitant to do it, but eventually all the other clans convinced her that she should, and so she did, and she was the leader of the clans of Mandalore, the ones that were left anyways. So that's a little bit different than what we're hearing here from Moff Gideon.
Okay, but going by these rules, if you had to guess, would you say that Moff Gideon had fought and defeated Sabine Wren to get the Darksaber, or fought and defeated Bo-Katan to get the Darksaber, or somebody else?
I think it would have had to been Bo-Katan, because she was the last one to have it. Sabine Wren had given it up. So my guess is that he won it from her, from Bo-Katan.
Okay.
If memory serves me right.
I'm sure there will be explanation of that at some point soon.
Yeah, I'm guessing next season there'll be a lot of stuff about the Darksaber and who's going to rule Mandalore. Probably some confrontation there between Mandalorian and Bo-Katan, I would guess.
Okay, so when last we checked in with our intrepid heroes, they were all aboard the bridge of the Star Destroyer, or of the cruiser. And one thing that you didn't mention, and that nobody cares about except for today, except me, is that it looks like the female Imperial comms officer was killed.
She was. Well, we don't know.
She's in this episode. She's running the she's doing the Lieutenant Uhura thing. And then the last time we see her, she's on the bridge. And then the next time we go to the bridge, everybody is dead on the bridge. But we didn't explicitly see her die. Yeah. So I hold out a little bit of hope that this character that has become so beloved to me has survived, has hit an escape pod, or is in like a little chamber hiding somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good chance that she did survive.
I hope so.
I read a little article that somebody was speculating, talking about Sabine Wren, that this comms officer was Sabine Wren. And it was kind of a sneak guest star in the Mandalorian episodes. And that later on we would find out that all along this was Sabine Wren in hiding. I don't necessarily believe that. They were kind of looking into the background of the actress and that she had done a lot of training in martial arts and things like that. And why bring somebody on for such a light role? But, you know, why give an actress with so much experience for such a light role?
Yeah, they do feature her, I think, in 4 episodes. And then to have just such a inconsequential death to the point where it's not even on the screen does seem like a misstep to me. Unfortunately, I feel like this episode is filled with missteps. So I don't know that there is method to the madness on this. I was just disappointed. And when you sent me that article today, I was like, oh, somebody else really likes that character as well, or has noticed that character as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Or that actress too. Yeah.
No, but hey, let's get to the point of the episode.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'll lead you off. While they're all arguing about the Darksaber, an alarm goes off, and there's a proximity alarm outside the cruiser of tons of attackers, and a Cara Dune says, or somebody says, how many life forms? And the answer is none. It is this entire squadron of Dark Troopers, and there's so many of them that there's no way they were just the ones that got sucked out into space. I have no idea where these guys came from, except for to say that they were on the ship that came and got my favorite Imperial comm officer from where she was hiding, and then they all dispatched while she fled to safety.
Well, let's hope.
But if I had to guess, I'd say there are 50 or more of these Dark Troopers.
Yeah, I was surprised at how many came back onto the cruiser.
And they're super impressive. And I watched them and I couldn't tell. I honestly couldn't tell if they were CG or guys in suits. They move like robots, like not like C-3PO, like a person, but like CG. But the way that the light bounces off them, the way that they have depth, I felt like they were really there. So I my guess is that these are stuntmen in these suits, but they were so impressive. And they're built in this really weird, giant, hunched over way where you'd think a person couldn't fit in that. Anyway, they all enter the ship. And Moff Gideon is so amused by this. I love this guy. He's just, he's smirking the whole time. And he said, you know, one dark trooper nearly handed Mandalorian his helmet. What are you going to do against this whole squadron? And as they approach, they close the blast doors, but they're not going to keep out these dark troopers. And Moff Gideon says, in a moment, everybody on this bridge is going to be dead, except for me and the child.
Yeah, which is really, I can't argue with him. I mean, all these dark troopers are storming the bridge, and it doesn't look good for our heroes, that's for sure. Yeah, and then there's another proximity alert or something, and we see an X-Wing show up. And Cara Dune even makes the point, one X-Wing? Wow.
We're saved.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who knew? And, you know, it comes in, it pulls in. Then, you know, all of the dark troopers just kind of stop.
Why do they stop?
Good point.
I understand narratively why they stop, but logically, I don't understand why they stop.
Yeah, you know, I guess the ones in the hangar or, you know, wherever the X-Wing pulls in, they might stop, or the ones that are closest to it. But the ones that are storming the bridge and pounding down the door like Rock'em Sock'em robots, you know, they wouldn't have stopped. So, yeah, that's a good point there. But so eventually, and the way they did this was really cool because we're seeing, you know, they're on the bridge and they're looking into these little monitors and they can see from the security cameras all the different parts of the ship, you know, the hangar and, you know, the parts that they fought through. And they're watching this on the monitors. And, you know, before we were just seeing all the dark troopers coming after them. But now we see a figure, a hooded figure, come into view. And then, oh, he's got a lightsaber. And he starts fighting against these dark troopers. Or we don't even know if it's a he at this point, right? He says smugly. It's kind of clouded. We don't know who it is either. I pretty much knew who it was when I saw the X-Wing show up. But they're playing it pretty coy here. And eventually we do see, they go from the security cameras to the actual place where the dark troopers are. And we see a green lightsaber. And then we see a gloved hand. And, you know, he's just cutting through all of these dark troopers. At this point, we pretty much know that it's Luke Skywalker, right?
Yeah, he takes out these dark troopers so easily that it's almost like the danger room with the X-Men. He's like practicing and trying like all of his moves. And he's like, okay, this one, I'm going to use the Force to deflect its blasts back at it and kill it that way. Okay, this one, I'm going to carve right up like a Thanksgiving turkey. This one, I'm not going to use my lightsaber at all. I'm just going to use the Force to crush it with my fist. It's so easy that, well, I mean, everything was so easy in this episode. It was like playing a video game where you turn on the difficulty level all the way to one. Yeah, every single one of these dark troopers fall, and then he comes in and he takes off his hood.
Right.
And why Cara Dune doesn't know who this guy is, I don't know. It needed a rewrite, because she knows who this guy is. Everybody in the New Republic should know who this guy is. He's the guy that avenged her planet.
Right.
That alone, she should know who this guy is. But anyway, he takes off the hood, and it's Luke Skywalker circa, I don't know, 1988, 1989. He knows what he's there for. Nobody attacks him, even though they're all like Mandalorians and stuff who are sworn enemies of the Jedi. He looks right at Grogu and, you know, he says, I'm here for the child.
Yeah, and the Mandalorian understood that. You know, he pretty much, you know, grabbed Grogu off the floor and put him on a chair there. And he knew why Luke was there. Or he didn't know it was Luke, of course, but he knew why this Jedi had come for Grogu, who had called him at the temple. But what I thought was funny was everybody else is scared to death because Luke is just waiting outside the door. He's not coming in after he destroyed the Dark Troopers. And so Mandalorian's like, well, open the door. And they're like, I'm not going to open the door. What's going on? I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, but they're all criminals except for Cara Dune. You know, like all of these guys are maybe not bad guys, but definitely enemies to the New Republic, I would think. Even Cara Dune probably was until 5 minutes ago. But also, yeah, a demonstration of that kind of power would make this guy terrifying. And he's got the hood and he's got the cloak. It's the exact outfit that he had on in the first scene of Return of the Jedi, well, the first scene he appears in. And so, yeah, that scene in Jedi was intentionally done so you didn't know who it was. So, you know, is that Vader? Is that somebody new kind of thing? And so, yeah, it's understandable that they didn't want to let him in. But Mandalorian is all too willing to open the doors. Oh, and one thing that you didn't mention that I really liked was that Grogu perked up the second that X-Wing arrived.
Yeah.
Like a dog hearing its master's car pull up in the driveway. And you've seen a dog do that. You've got a dog right now. It's just really cool to hear that they recognize and they're excited and all that. And Grogu at one point goes up to the security monitor and he puts his little hand on the screen while Luke is laying waste to these robots, which is, I guess, just the Force calling to the Force is what I think it is. There's no way he's ever met Luke Skywalker because he's been in captivity for 50 years, but he knows who it is. He knows that this guy is here for him. And I think that that's really special.
Yeah, you know, Grogu may have felt Luke's presence while he was at the temple and the skybeam was going up and he was communing with the Force or whatever. So he may have recognized Luke's presence from that. But who knows? He might just realize that this is a Jedi, that this is, he feels the Force and knows who this is. You know, like you said, Luke knows why he's there. You know, he's there for the child, for Grogu, and Mandalorian knows it too. And so he tells Grogu to come to him. He says, you know, come here. He's interested, but he's also looking at the Mandalorian. And Luke tells Din Djarin that he's asking for your permission. He wants to know that you're okay with it. And so, you know, Din Djarin picks him up and he says, hey, you need to go with this guy. He's like you. He can teach you. He knows how to help you, and I don't. And, you know, Grogu kind of reaches up and touches his mask, and then the Mandalorian realizes he wants him to take his mask off. And so he does. He takes his mask off, and Grogu touches his face. And it's a really kind of sweet moment between Grogu and Din Djarin here. And Mandalorian, he doesn't care at this point about the way or whatever. He wants to relate to Grogu before he goes away with Luke. And I thought it was done really well. And you could tell how emotional Din Djarin was. Because he knew this is it, that Grogu was going to leave.
We missed a scene. We missed a scene where Moff Gideon grabs a blaster. And who does he shoot? Well, he shoots Koska Reeves. I just wondered if you knew her name. He shoots her a bunch of times, and then, yeah, he tries to shoot the child, and Mando throws himself in front of the laser blast, which is nice always. And then Gideon takes the blaster, and he puts it under his own chin to commit suicide, which we've never seen somebody do with a blaster before. But Cara Dune is there, and she wallops him in the face with, like, the butt of her enormous rifle, and takes him out, you know, disarms him, knocks him out. But Koska Reeves gets up and she's fine. So that's disappointing. Sorry, it just needed one more draft. It really did. And it would have been just a perfect episode. I feel like Koska Reeves is the only expendable character on that bridge and they could have killed her off.
Yeah, I can see that.
Or they could have had two or three characters with them that the stormtroopers killed or the dark troopers killed, so that we would feel palpable tension. But no, everybody's all right. And yeah, you're right. Luke picks up the baby and he says, you know, may the force be with you. Mando says, I'll see you again. I promise, to the child.
Yeah.
And then he cries when the boy goes, which I thought was very nice. Do you think that he will see the child again?
I think so. You know, I don't know to what capacity, but, you know, I would assume it next season we might see Grogu. You know, I don't know if the Mandalorian would go and visit Grogu wherever Luke is training Jedi or not, but I think they've got to bring him back at some point because, you know, their relationship is the magic of the show, like we've talked about. So they've been together since the beginning, you know, since, was it the very first episode or did they meet in the second episode of the first season?
No, the first episode ends with him touching the baby's finger. Did I tell you in that episode that I talked to Big about it? And I said, what do you think? Do you think we'll get like one more season with just the two of them jetting around together? And then at the end of season three, he'll give the child to the Jedi. And Big said, no, as long as the show goes, it's always going to be Mandalorian and the child. So they know what side their bread is buttered on, is what he said. He's like, they're not going to split these guys up because that would be dumb. That's what people are watching for.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I guess we should sit Big down and say, was that a mistake then to split them up now?
I guess we'll see. They must have plans. I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure season three is very far along in development and it's probably has several episodes written. So I assume they know what's going on and they have big plans for the Mandalorian. But, you know, it's probably going to be about him coming to and reconciling with his Mandalorian heritage and, you know, tussling with Bo-Katan over the Darksaber and who's going to rule Mandalorian, even though he doesn't want it. He has the Darksaber. So I think that'll be a big thrust of the next season.
Well, I wished that they had established a rapport between Din Djarin and Bo-Katan.
Yeah.
That they were actually friends so that it would be all the more stressful that they have to fight. That there has to be, you know, a defeat kind of thing. And I suppose that they can build that eventually. But it has been a problem that we have seen since the prequels of setting up two characters that have to fight eventually. But the closer they are, the more they love each other, the more powerful that fight is. Not that Bo-Katan and Mandalorian have to love each other, but it's just, I want them to be like Kirk and Spock in Amok Time, where it's like, you have to fight to the death, but we're best friends. That kind of thing is so cool, and it works so much better then these guys hardly know each other and she's just always nasty anyway. And so maybe they can build toward that in this season three. We also have Moff Gideon having some part to play in the future, I would think. Otherwise, they would have just let him kill himself.
Right, yeah. He's got to be there.
He said, I got what I wanted. I just wanted the blood. But for what? They said something about clones, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, you know, and I don't know, you know, obviously he wanted more than the blood. He probably wanted Grogu to be there for a constant supply or something like that. But, you know, Dr. Pershing is still around. So, you know, he knows the answers to those questions. What did Gideon want with the blood? But we kind of went past Luke a little bit and you probably don't want to talk about it. But I did want to talk about the CGI a little bit.
Well,
because last time we talked about it, I think it was the tragedy episode, we had speculated that it could be Luke Skywalker that would come. And you liked the idea of a CGI Mark Hamill because it looks so good in Rise of Skywalker. And so I just wonder, do you think that was a wrong choice at this point?
Yeah, it's hard for me to admit when I'm wrong, but I was wrong.
You know, it was disappointing. I think both of us agree to that. But anyway, let's talk about it. What were your feelings, or what do you think they could have done better with the CGI for Luke?
Yeah, to quote Han Solo, "I'm trying not to, kid." It's not there yet, and I don't understand why it doesn't work that way. I've seen it work in really exceptional ways. Probably that Luke Skywalker flashback in Rise of Skywalker was the best I've ever seen. Also, there's a shot in, or a character in Blade Runner 2049, where they recreate Sean Young from when she was Sean Young, that I thought was really, really good. But because she's a replicant, it's okay if she looks wrong. Michael Douglas, young Michael Douglas in the first Ant-Man, I thought was really cool. At the beginning of the terrible recent Terminator movie, they've got a young Sarah Connor and a young John Connor, and I thought that those looked absolutely perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Like the best youthening I'd ever seen in a movie ever. But Cameron said that originally John Connor had lines, and it didn't look right, so they cut all the lines. Luke, when he speaks, his mouth doesn't quite work. His eyes don't quite look at anything. He looks like an animated cutscene from a video game that's really good. It's so clearly supposed to be young Mark Hamill, but it didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And if it worked for you, then I envy you. I really do. That last shot in Rogue One just took me out of the movie so badly. But for the people that it didn't, they were crying. They were so pleased to see Leia alive again. Well, this was the year before she died, so I don't know what I'm talking about. I think it was. She died between Rogue One and Last Jedi,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right.
Yeah, I feel like she died in December of 2016, and Rogue One came out in December of 2016. But there's this thing, and sorry to derail the conversation, but there's this thing called deepfake.
Deepfake.
And it's a program that you can install, you can buy, you can do with yourself. And I've seen amateurs do deepfakes that are wholly convincing with a W. And I've seen people do Carrie Fisher's face, map it over that last shot from Rogue One, and she's alive again. It's actually Carrie Fisher. And just in a week, somebody used deepfake, scanned Mark Hamill's face from Return of the Jedi, and put it over that scene. And it's not as good as the Carrie Fisher one, but it looks better than what I saw in the episode. And it cost him nothing.
Right.
I wish that they had just left the hood on, the same as I had said in Rogue One. I wish they'd left the hood on Leia. If it's not there, just keep him in shadow, or have the dark troopers start to get through the door and all the lights go out. And so the light of Luke's lightsaber is the only light that hits his face that gives us an excuse to keep him in shadow, to keep it hidden. But having said that, I know there are people that were floored, that were so happy to see young Luke again, that suddenly they were 8 years old or 10 years old or 146 years old, however they were when they first saw Return of the Jedi. And I wish I could feel that way. I think that's great. I wanted to feel that, but I just have a picadillo, you know? I have a pet peeve with CG, with faces, human beings. How about you?
Yeah, you know, I like I said, I was disappointed with it as well. I didn't let it ruin the moment for me. I liked that Luke was there. I liked that Grogu was going with him, but I wish it would have been better as far as his appearance. You know, you marked all these examples. You know, the other one I thought of was Robert Downey Jr. in, was it Age of Ultron? Where they show him as a young teenager in a little simulation there. That I thought that was spot on, that he looked like Robert Downey Jr. from one of his, you know, weird science movies or something like that. And so I don't know whether it was budget, whether it was time constraints, you know, why they couldn't make Luke look better. You know, they have all the footage from Return of the Jedi and everything. You know, they should have been able to pull that off better. I don't know. You know, I didn't see the Irishman either. I think that was what Martin Scorsese did one with, you know, de-aged Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro and stuff, you know. I the technology is there. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. You know, Lucasfilm could have borrowed some of the technology from Marvel. They were both owned by Disney, so I don't know what to say.
That Robert De Niro movie, none of that looked right either.
Okay, well, there you go.
We've talked about this before because it's my biggest complaint is just the bad CG thing. That our whole mental makeup is to recognize faces, to recognize, I know this person, I don't know this person. It kept us alive when we were living in caves, when there were tribes, when there were Smilodons trying to eat us and stuff like that, of instantaneously recognizing whether something is a person, whether it's somebody that you know, whether it is safety or whether you need to hide or fight. And so that's going to be the hardest thing to ever convince somebody of. But I know that it is possible to work around things like that, and I know that it is possible to do certain things. For example, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 starts with a flashback with young Kurt Russell, and all they did was shave his facial hair and put a wig on him. They didn't do the digital de-aging. Now, granted, I don't suppose you could do that with Mark Hamill, because just his features have become too rough over the years. But there are ways to work around things. You don't always have to go the most expensive route.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if it's the timing of all this as well. You know, it's actually a pretty big gamble for Favreau to write this into the script and just assume that the technology is going to pull it off, you know, to actually bring Luke to life, a young Luke to life on screen. And I wonder if he feels that the gamble paid off, that it was worth it to bring him in. You know, I love that he's in there, but, you know, was it worth it to them? Was it worth it to have Luke in the script with the CGI?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because for a lot of people, it worked just fine. So as far as those people are concerned, it was worth it. Whatever they spent on it, however they did it, was fine. I'm watching the deepfake right now, and even it doesn't quite work spectacularly well because what we're looking at is a Mark Hamill face put over the CG Mark Hamill face put over a double. But surely they tried certain things and tried to see how they could make it work. And I just feel like they bit off a little more than they could chew. They could, like I said, with the lighting, like I said, with the hood, they could have wrecked the ship. And so they never get that close to Luke, or the camera never gets that close to Luke.
Yeah, we did get another voicemail from Bria since the finale has come out. Just one this time. But she talked about how excited she was that Luke Skywalker was back. But she does admit that he didn't look perfect. But anyway, I should probably let Bria speak for herself. Maybe this is a good point to play her voicemail.
Hi, Rich and Marshall. I'm calling again on a run, so I hope you can hear me. I have my headset on, so I'm going to try to talk loud enough. I had to call again because the finale of season 2, it came out, and spoilers, in case for any reason you haven't watched it yet, I imagine you have, but I'm going to not bury the lead. I loved it so much that Luke Skywalker came back. It was so awesome. I want to know what you guys think. I know you're going to tell us, so that's great. But I personally was so happy to see that. And it's just the single X-Wing, and even Cara Dune says, like, oh, a single X-Wing is going to come help us escape. And you don't know, is it Ahsoka? Is it somebody else? And like, I think, you know, they're going to let us see Luke Skywalker. And then the green lightsaber, and I seriously wanted to, like, get up and cheer. It was just so awesome to see him fight those dark troopers who totally reminded me of Terminators. So anyway, just had to talk about that really briefly as my final message, that the CGI, you know, I'm curious what you guys think, because I wasn't bothered by it. It wasn't great, it wasn't terrible, but I was so excited to see Luke that I didn't care. It was pretty awesome just to see him And, of course, Din Djarin taking his helmet off so that Grogu could see his face was like, here! that was really powerful. So, looking forward to hearing you guys talk about this. I'm also looking up at Saturn and Jupiter coming so close to each other that they look like a single bright star tonight. I imagine you guys might have heard about this happening. So, that's pretty cool. I'm looking at it right now, and it's really bright. So, anyway, I look forward to the final chat that you guys have about the last two chapters, and especially finding out, what do you guys think? Were you so happy to see Luke? Were you upset that it didn't look perfect? Which it didn't. I can admit that. So, eagerly waiting for your guys' thoughts. Okay. Good night.
Oh, okay. Well, cards on the table. I hadn't heard Bria's voicemail when we recorded this episode until now. And then I had to just find a place to randomly stick it in the episode. And Marshall said, yeah, just find a place. You'll make it work. The thing is, gosh, she's got such nice things to say. And I don't want to just randomly stick it in the middle of me complaining. But that's what I got to do. We've all been to places with other people, and we responded in one way and they responded in another. Well, we went and saw Titanic opening night. It would have been December, I want to say 19th, 1997. And it was a life-changing experience for my sister. It was her favorite movie of all time. You know, that held the record for a long time. I don't know. For her, it was like Return of the Jedi was for me. And I remember just a few years later, a couple of years later, my friend Jeff and his wife and I, we all went and saw Pearl Harbor. And two of us wept through like the last 20 minutes of the movie. And one of us just did not get why Jeff and I were so moved by the movie. I can't even really explain it, because when I say that, people just, they laugh. Because Pearl Harbor is a punchline. Everything speaks to somebody in a different way. And I am happy for the people that were really moved and really thrilled and really pleased by this season finale. And it makes me feel a little dirty that I wasn't. But you feel what you feel. And maybe, you know, this whole purpose of life is to feel empathy toward other people, to try to understand how that person got to where they are and feel the way that they feel. And now I feel like I'm encroaching on politics here. Let me just continue the rest of the podcast as it stands. But let me say thank you, Bria, for calling. And I appreciate her calling and I appreciate her feelings. I think it's admirable that they wrote it that way and said, we're going to pull this off. And it's neat, like the John Williams music comes up when he's first revealed to be Luke Skywalker. And
right, yeah.
Of course it's going to be Luke. That's great. I mean, he is... Before all this nonsense about the Star Wars movies being about Darth Vader, it was called From the Adventures of Luke Skywalker.
Right.
I just hope that when they use him again, if they use him again, they just, you know, do a few more shots of the back of his head or of a hologram or of, you know, him standing far away or there being smoke. And that was totally something that they could have done. He's killed a million of these droids. There could have been so much smoke that it was like the Ahsoka scenes.
Yeah, or you know, I guess he could have had oil or grease splashed on his face or something.
See, that's something Spielberg would have done. He would have done something like that, where he's just like, well, it doesn't look exactly right. What if we come up with a reason? What if his cloak catches fire when he's fighting these guys? And so there's like some soot on his face. But any of those things, just thinking outside the box, are useful. And I told you when I first saw the episode that I was disappointed by it. I probably used even stronger words than that.
Yeah. I think you said that this episode gave you everything you wanted, but it was the episode you liked the least.
I say this about movies all the time. It just needed one more draft, where they made it more dangerous and more deadly and more... Just because I just didn't buy that any of these characters were ever in danger, except for the Mandalorian when he was fighting the one dark trooper.
But I talked to people that just, yeah, their eyes were red from how hard they cried. And I wish that I could have felt that way.
Yeah, I watched a video of somebody that was watching, you know, doing a reaction while watching the show. And yeah, they were in tears. I guess I'm wired different. I mean, I cry at movies. I cry at things I watch. It's usually because something's sad or extremely happy. Not just because, you know, something exciting has happened. I'm excited if something happens, but I don't necessarily cry.
But see, I was in tears when IG-11 sacrificed himself for his friends at the end of season one.
Right.
And we should certainly care more about Jin and the child and Luke than we do about, you know, an assassin droid that we've met two episodes previous. But part of it is that they only do 8 episodes. And I hate to use the word lazy, but 8 episodes is just so little. They could have milked this stuff way, way more than they did. In fact, I thought that they would, you know. I thought that we would get a whole season trying to find the Jedi. Or, you know, with Ahsoka Tano filling in the pieces and finding out what is going on and how hard it is to find Moff Gideon. But they solved it all in one episode, and I feel like that's a mistake too. They set Gideon up as this insanely powerful bad guy with legions at his disposal, and I felt like he came off really, really well, but it was still just too easy to defeat him.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I think it was wrapped up a little bit too quick. And, you know, like I said, I don't know what's in store for season 3. You know, maybe there's cooler things to come and they needed to wrap up this storyline. I don't know. It's hard to say, you know, what kind of pressures and constraints they're up against either. And to be honest, though, I'm a little bit worried about all these other shows coming. And, you know, I don't want them to lose their focus and lose their mojo, I guess. And, you know, trying to spin too many plates. Ultimately, I guess, though, you know, with Luke, you know, I think Luke was the right answer for who's the Jedi that you want to come get Grogu. You know, Luke's the best answer. And I just wished it would have been pulled off a little better with the special effects, like we've said over and over.
Yeah, somebody postulated that the Jedi that saved Grogu from the Jedi Temple before Order 66 was Mace Windu, and that he's still out there alive somewhere. And I just hope that they don't do that. I love Sam Jackson. I want him to get as much work as possible, but I don't need that. I don't need him to have also survived, in addition to the Emperor also surviving. And there's probably 5 or 6 other people that somehow also survived, but I can't think of them right now.
Yeah, that's a little too much.
And you know what? Even if Mace Windu did remove him from the Jedi Temple, you know, at some point, that doesn't mean that he had to have survived being disarmed by Anakin and then shot with lightning and then dropped off of a building. But now that we have all these shows, they can all go their separate ways and then have like little crossovers like Buffy and Angel would have from time to time and, you know, tell their own stories with their own characters. But so-and-so goes on to this show, who goes on to this show, who goes on to this show. If they're all being produced by the same people and they're all being shot at the same place, there's no reason why you wouldn't really, really build that up. But like Rangers of the New Republic can have anybody show up on it. Cobb Vanth can show up on Rangers of the New Republic. Isn't Cara Dune the Ranger of the New Republic?
I thought it would be X-Wing pilots that were the Rangers. Maybe I have that wrong.
Well, the X-Wing pilots are the movie that Patty Jenkins is doing.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know.
Although I guess there could be crossover there too. Why not? Cross-pollinization.
Yeah, I guess for some reason, you know, I had my mind that, you know, the two X-Wing pilots that were, you know, Filoni and the other guy, that they would be the Rangers.
From the Spider episode?
But I guess you're right. I probably have that wrong.
So, yeah, they gave all these hints that it was Luke. Was there anybody that was surprised when the hood came down that it was Luke? It seems like Favreau was deliberately undercutting the tension by giving you baby steps so that everybody knew that it was Luke. But I'm not sure why you would do that.
Yeah, you know, I guess you're just trying to catch the casual fan and the diehard fan, you know, together so that everybody's caught up. It was kind of fun, you know, when I was watching it with my family, you know, because they were like, who is it? Is it Luke? And I'm like, as soon as I saw the X-Wing, I'm like, yeah, that's Luke. But then, you know, I'd say things like, oh, there's the green lightsaber. Just, you know, to try to egg him on a little bit. And then when R2 came in at the end, he kind of had his little moment with Grogu. I'm like, just in case you didn't know it was Luke Skywalker, here's R2-D2.
Yeah, I didn't appreciate R2 as much as I should. I don't know why that is. Because anybody can play R2? Is that why?
I guess. I really liked him in the show, that he was there.
So we got to quit. We've been going for 11 hours and 41 minutes on this episode. But I don't know what they do in season 3. At some point, you risk killing the goose that lays the golden eggs by splitting up these two. And, you know, I don't know Bria all that well, but my guess is that Bria has a lot of emotional investment in the relationship between Grogu and Din Djarin. And what do you do when that's gone? I'm in it for Din Djarin, for the Mandalorian, and so I'm back no matter what. But I don't want the ratings to go way down or for them to lose half their audience that are there for the cute kid. So just today, I saw an interview with Jon Favreau where he talks about the future of this show. And right now they are shooting The Book of Boba Fett, which is not Mandalorian Season 3. And as soon as that is done, they will start with Mandalorian Season 3, which means we don't get Mandalorian in 2021.
Yeah, I know. That's kind of a shocker.
It sounds like, you know, it'll be shortly after Book of Boba Fett ends its run that we'll get Mandalorian Season 3. So you don't have to wait that long. But it's still longer than we've had to wait. And I don't know what they do. Okay, so we've got the stuff with the Darksaber.
Yeah.
And maybe Mandalore is this awesome place. And everybody in the galaxy hears that this guy has the Darksaber. So all you have to do is kill this guy and you get to rule Mandalore. And that would put a neat target on Din Djarin's head, which might be cool. They could do that for several episodes if they wanted to. He has to get a new ship. I don't know who he's riding with, because Slave One took off, although eventually I'm assuming Slave One came back to get Fennec Shand. There's this really neat ship that we see in a couple of shots at the very beginning of the episode that has to be Bo-Katan's ship, that kind of looks like the Jedi Starfighter from the prequels, but it's not. It's just a really pretty angular ship. And then there's the Lambda-class shuttle that they steal. I guess that could be something Mandalorian is flying around in for a while. But again, there's a target painted on you there when you're flying this thing, because it announces high up Imperial officer or dignitary on board.
Yeah, I think it'll be pretty interesting to see what they come up with for a new ship for the Mandalorian. You know, they have to have something in the works.
Anyway, do you want to talk about the post-credit sequence? Because I don't.
Well, I guess we should speak about it a little bit. I guess the biggest thing I'm interested in is, what did you think of Bib Fortuna?
I don't know. That didn't look like Bib Fortuna to me. I know that it was, but he'd gained, what, 180 pounds? Yeah. I think that they were saying, you know, he's Jabba now. He's running Jabba's organization. What was Jabba's organization called? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I thought it was just the Hutts, you know, that they had their own crime syndicate or whatever, and they worked together. I didn't know somebody that was not a Hutt could run the organization, but evidently so.
Well, he's running Jabba's palace, that's for sure. And a lot of the aliens from Return of the Jedi are there. A lot of the guys that we've seen before. I saw like a dancing girl in the back that I don't think had been in part of Return of the Jedi. And then there's also a new Twi'lek slave girl chained to the dais So some things never change.
Yeah, there's a weak way.
And there is a weak way, sort of as his majordomo. But they're all killed so fast, except for the girl, that it sort of doesn't matter.
Yeah, I just thought it was kind of cool that they did a post-credit scene. I think that's the first that we've seen from Lucasfilm. Yeah, I also thought it was kind of cool that they saved it for this end credit scene and didn't talk about it at all during all the big announcements that were made for Disney. Yeah, I don't know if it was a secret or what.
It was a secret, though. I for some reason, Favreau convinced Kathy Kennedy not to talk about it so that it would be a surprise for those that stuck around the credits of Mandalorian. How many people do you suppose stuck around? How many people watched the credits?
Yeah, I would guess a lot of people missed it. We just happened to be watching the credits or talking while the credits were going. I always make sure that we watch the episode art as the credits are rolling. And then after that, I don't care so much if I see the rest of the credits. But we were just talking about the show and whatnot while the credits were rolling. And then all of a sudden, we were inside of Jabba's palace. So I would guess a lot of people turned it off. And then later on, they heard on the internet that there was this extra after credit scene. And so they went back and watched it at the end of the episode.
Well, that's the neat thing about television is that you always can. If people had gotten up and left the theater and missed the post-credit sequence, which I'm sure happened at the first few Marvel movies. I wonder what percentage of people saw Nick Fury at the end of Iron Man. Half? A third? But then you hear about it later and it's like, oh shoot, honey, we need to go see that again so that we can go see that. And everybody wins there.
Yeah.
So yeah, the scene is Fennec Shand and Boba Fett come to Jabba's palace. They kill everybody. And then Boba Fett sits down on this throne that Bib Fortuna died on. Then they just pose and the camera pulls back.
Yeah.
Fennec Shand has a drink of that glowing blue stuff. And then it says the Book of Boba Fett coming December 2021. I've no idea what the Book of Boba Fett will be. Unless it's just a meaner version of The Mandalorian.
Yeah, maybe you'll get your wish that Boba Fett will be a bad guy again.
Yeah, he's so cool, but you could have him be a bad guy without a code, and he's still cool. But we'll see. I mean, he had very little to do in this episode because he took off after they got onto the Imperial ship. But I wondered what would have happened had Boba Fett been part of that assault there at the end. Because once Luke Skywalker shows up, those two are not friends.
Yeah.
And that would have been interesting. I don't love Boba Fett enough to have been satisfied with him not getting his head cut off by a green lightsaber in that scene. But that was smart on Favreau's part to have Boba Fett take off and not come back. Because that is the one enemy of Luke Skywalker that would not have been pleased to see him show. Everybody else can say, this isn't my fight.
Right. Yeah, that would have been an interesting confrontation. And like you said, I think it's wise that Boba Fett was missing.
A lot of people were thrilled that we got to see Luke be super, super powerful. Something that I guess was just technologically infeasible in 1983. We see him kill like a lot of guys on Jabba's skiff and things like that, but it's never like this. And I guess we can say that in the 5 years or 6 years, maybe by this point, since Return of the Jedi, he's just gotten more and more and more powerful. And I can buy that. I'm fine with that. A lot of people were also saying that this was a lyrical mirror to Darth Vader hacking his way through the blockade runner at the end of Rogue One.
Right.
And
yeah, I thought I was going to have the exclusive take on that, but everybody else thought of it too.
Oh, see, because I found that to be totally spurious. I was just like, you guys are just reaching here. Because one is hacking through a bunch of defenseless, screaming human beings. But, that's just me. Like father, like son, if they had matched shots and stuff like that, intentionally so that you would be reminded that this was the son of Darth Vader, I think that would be really neat.
Yeah, kind of, you know, you got the power of the dark side versus the power of the light side there. But then again, you know, Darth Vader was hacking through human beings and Luke was slicing through robots. So there's that.
I have said this before, but I feel like it's a real shame that we never got to see Darth Vader, the evil Darth Vader, helping with this Jedi purge thing, going from planet to planet, killing Jedi. And I understand that it's that's not something that kids want to see. You know, they don't want to see the good guys exterminated by the baddest of the bad guys. But I've understood that there have been a bunch of comics that they've done where it's just, you know, Vader tracks down so-and-so who escaped Order 66 or had retired from the Jedi Order before Order 66. And issue after issue is him finding new guys and killing them. And I would really enjoy reading that. I don't know that you can make a show or a movie about it.
Yeah, probably not. You know, I think Dark Horse did some comics like that, like you're saying. And I've read a couple, and they're pretty good.
But if they're truly bringing Vader back for Obi-Wan Kenobi, then there's your opportunity to see something like that.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
Because there are other Jedi out there, and it's possible that Kenobi is in contact with them. And so that is drama right there. We know that Kenobi can't be killed, but the people that he cares about can be. And so you've got a tension there.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm talking about future things when we shouldn't be. Let's do an episode where we talk about like all the new shows and what we're expecting of them.
Yeah, we definitely need to do that. Yeah, we just had to put that on hold so we could finish off the Mandalorian stuff here. But yeah, maybe we can get others to join us on the show as well. I think that'd be a lot of fun to kind of talk about each one in turn. But I definitely wanted to pay due to The Mandalorian because it's such a good show.
What was your favorite episode of the season?
I'd have to say my favorite was probably the Ahsoka episode because there was just so much good in terms of the story and being introduced to Ahsoka. But I also liked The Marshal because, you know, that was titled after me. But no, I liked that episode because of the Western tropes. I mean, it was probably the best Western take of the series. You know, they did some of it in season one, but this one was really cool, you know, with coming into town, all the townspeople watching you come in, you know, you're a stranger, a man with no name, and then you meet up with the Marshal and then it turns into a horror episode like Tremors. And I just thought that was kind of cool. But definitely the Ahsoka episode.
Cool. Yeah, my favorite episodes were the Ahsoka episode and the spider episode, the second one. I loved the spider stuff. And
yeah, that one was great too.
It, well, it was just so different than all the other episodes that we'd gotten. And so, yeah, those were the two that I liked the most. I liked the one we talked about last time with Mayfeld.
Yep, so many good episodes.
And I'm disappointed that we have so few episodes and then we're going to have over a year to wait. But there's going to be just an embarrassment of riches to keep using that term of Star Wars coming that we'll see if people get sick of Star Wars in the long run.
Yeah, like I said, when all those shows and movies and projects were announced, I was a little bit leery of oversaturation. And hopefully they do they pace it out good. They're probably going to have to split out the production of it as well. I'm excited about all the shows they've announced. Well, most of them, maybe not all of them, but it'll be interesting to see what lies for us in the future of Star Wars.
Well, we've got 3 years, almost exactly 3 years from when we're recording this before our next Star Wars film.
Right.
And so that's plenty of time to talk about any conceivable thing. We've got all the new books coming out, the High Republic stuff that we'll be able to talk about, new animated shows. So I hope people will continue to watch with us. Thank you for wasting another evening with me. And for all of you who have listened, you can call that voicemail line and share stuff with us, ask us questions that we can talk for 20 minutes about. What's the telephone number again?
That is 77JN2107.
That's 77JN2107. And feel free to support us on Patreon. Let us know that you enjoy this show and you want more of it, as well as our own shows. I have the Rish Outcast. Marshall has the Journey Into podcast. And we will see you in 2021. I hope that this new year is a good one.
Yes, have a good year, and we look forward to coming back and talking about more Star Wars stuff here on the podcast. And so, Rish, talent without training is nothing. That's what Luke told the Mandalorian about Grogu.
Oh, okay. I was trying to figure out where that was from.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Joey here says the Delusions of Grandeur podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 license. That means you can copy this thing from the inner systems all the way to the Outer Rim territories. Share it with Imperials or your basic rebel types. But you can't change it or try to sell it. If you're in it for the money, you'll have to deal with Chewbacca here. And Wookiees are known to pull listeners' ears out of their sockets when they misuse. Hey, it was the chair. I don't care what you smell.
Of anybody from, what's it called? What's the Knights of the New Republic show called? What's it?
I think it's...
Heroes of the...
I think it's Rangers?
That doesn't sound right either. Why do I not know?
Rangers of the New Republic.
Oh, okay. If you say so. It still sounds wrong. What, I trust your memory. It's fine. Except for, what is the name of the sidekick to Bo-Katan?
That is Koska Reeves.
Dang, you got it. All right. I played my cards one time too many.